You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
T-Rat indicates a criminal shift to a longer game. Chinese industrial espionage copies Russian services tricks. Dharma ransomware evolves. Bitcoin's price may be tanking, but Bitcoin-based advanced fee scams are still all over Twitter with bogus big brands, blue checks all over them. Nigeria plans to go after cyber gangs. Fancy Bear says it can't be sued even if it did anything. And why a password manager is better than an infernal machine. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, November 15th, 2018. Researchers at the security firm Proofpoint have described a new modular remote access Trojan, T-Rat. This rat arrives with social engineering, phishing emails with malicious Microsoft Word documents attached. T-Rat is distributed by the criminal group familiar from its involvement with the notorious Drydex campaigns in 2014, the Locky crime spree in 2016 and 17, and many other attacks as well. That group, Proofpoint, tracks as TA-505. It's criminal, of course, and its motive is financial. No reasons of state here. Proofpoint describes the group's activities as structured in an informative way, one that can help defenders recognize similar campaigns. First is the actor itself, most interesting because recognizing the human motivations of the attacker can inform defense. Then there's the vector, the delivery mechanism. In the case of TA-505, that mechanism has been a spam-serving botnet, sometimes owned by TA-505 and sometimes leased. The third element is the hoster, usually a macro-enabled document that pulls its malicious payload from a host server. The payload itself is the fourth element. It's the malware that enables the attackers to work their will on the victim machines. And finally, there's command and control, the link between the malware and the attackers. TA-505 and other capable actors use a range of command and control servers, which renders them resilient in the face of sinkholing, takedowns, and other enforcement actions. TA-505 has tended to be a ransomware specialist, but its turn toward remote access Trojans suggests that it's now playing a longer game. As Proofpoint puts it, this represents, quote, a broader shift towards loaders, stealers, and other malware designed to reside on devices and provide long-term returns on investment to threat actors, end quote. There's another new ransomware threat out there, a refreshed and evolved version of the Dharma strain. Researchers at Heimdall Security have been tracking new strains of the familiar ransomware. The latest version successfully evades detection by most antivirus software. Nation-state threat actors are also currently active. A cyber espionage campaign against engineering and maritime targets in the UK has been traced by cybersecurity company Recorded Future to a Chinese threat actor known variously as Temp.Periscope and Leviathan. We'll say Leviathan for now. And note that it seems to be engaged in the now very familiar Chinese practice of industrial espionage. Leviathan's case is interesting because of the way it points out the extent to which different nation-states' intelligence services sometimes share and more often simply copy the methods of their competitors in espionage. Leviathan makes interesting use of techniques apparently repurposed from the Russian threat actors Dragonfly and APT-28, that is, Fancy Bear, the GRU with its restored R. If you relied solely on style, you might conclude this activity originated in Moscow as opposed to Shanghai. The threat of nation-state attacks on private companies leads to a certain amount of understandable anxiety among security professionals. We checked in with Observit CEO Mike McKee for his take on how serious a threat nation-state actors really are and how much of an uptick they're really seeing.
I think the short answer is increasingly often. Fortunately, it's nowhere near the majority. More and more, there's risk there in terms of competitive trade secrets and intellectual property leaving, and this is more larger companies. It's something we're hearing more and more of as being on the radar of security folks at large companies.
So how do you dial in what would be a reasonable, practical, proportional response?
Yeah, it's almost a little bit by vertical. You know, manufacturing and pharmaceuticals. Yeah, I would say a third of the time we're hearing that as a threat. That's probably up from 10, you know, around 10% of the time before as something that's on their radar that they're looking out for.
I guess what I'm getting at is I hear a lot of people say that attribution isn't necessarily so important. Does it matter if the attacks coming in are from a nation state or from your run-of-the-mill criminals who are trying to get something to either steal or sell?
I would say yes, because I think more often when it's at the nation-state level, it's a direct competitor. I headed down to D.C. tomorrow to see a bunch of folks that we work with that, you know, get a lot of this information firsthand. But the particular individual we partnered with was at one of the larger pharmaceutical companies. You know, they would regularly see employees planted in the organization whose job it was to get intellectual property back to China. I do think that the difference between just selling it on the web and the different, you know, areas of the dark web and to actual countries or nation states is it gets into the hands of better, well-funded competitors faster.
And are there any specific indicators that point to a nation state actor specifically?
We work with this partner down in D.C., and most of the folks there came out of the CIA. I mean, they have literal websites that people go back to. They have organization names who they'll communicate back to. They know from their investigative work what sites are set up and what information repositories are set up, where they're trying to get it to. They have the addresses and the URLs, and that's what they look for. And that's what we look for with them as we build that information into the alerting capability of our product.
Do you suppose that this notion of being attacked by nation states has in some way become kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card for people who've been breached? I mean, it's one thing to say that some crooks got in, but it's another thing to say, well, a nation state got us, and what could we have done with an attack that sophisticated?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Meaning people are always trying to know the why or where it came from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that whole mean time to detect, mean time to remediate is always on people's mind. It's no better if it's a data breach from some kid in the basement in the U.S. than it is a nation state. If customer information's gotten out or intellectual property's gotten out, whether, like I said, it's to an individual trying to sell on the dark web or a competitor across the street or a competitor in China, I don't think there's any less concern on that. I don't think people are like, oh, well, you know, you can get the guy next door, you get the guy in the basement, but I understand you can't get China or Russia because their job is to make sure that, you know, as little information goes out as possible. You know, one of our new board members, Dave DeWalt, I was actually just looking up the quote, but he was saying that 29 countries have declared cyber commands, including, you know, basically said they're going to use offensive cybersecurity methods to get information. These are more nation states as opposed to companies in those countries, but often there's a pretty blurry line between those two things.
Right.
So 29 have actually declared they're doing it. 60 other countries say they've got the ability to do it. And that's just a completely different level than it was 5 years ago. So it's almost, I mean, exaggerating a little bit, but Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, as we know, sort of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, cybersecurity. And it's an arm that nation states have to get information, which is becoming increasingly accepted.
That's Mike McKee from Observe It. The implausible but depressingly effective Bitcoin-based advanced fee scam, as in send us Bitcoin and we'll send you 10 more Bitcoin in return, has assumed new forms, with major brands' Twitter accounts being hijacked or spoofed to convince the unwary. Target and Google are among those major brands whose blue-checked names are being fraudulently used to bubble people out of their cash, and a lot of observers are impatiently grumbling that it seems Twitter ought to do something. Bitcoin itself, we note, has seen its price crash below $6,000 on trading markets this week, as speculators apparently fear a coming fork in the blockchain. Nigeria's new cyber command, staffed by technically proficient military officers, is expected to help with counterterrorism. The government also hopes the young organization will take a toll on the country's organized cyber criminals. That will be a challenge. The gangs are a deeply rooted subculture. It's no accident that the classic advanced fee scam is the email from the widow of a fictional Nigerian prince. That scam is so iconic it's even known as a 419 scam, after Section 419 of the Nigerian Criminal Code that makes such stuff illegal. Good luck to the young cyber command. Fancy Bear says the DNC can't sue them, according to ABC News and other outlets. Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear got their pals over in the Ministry of Justice to say that. Even if they did hack the Democratic National Committee, the DNC can't sue them. And they're not saying they did, it's more that they're speaking hypothetically on behalf of a friend. That's the claim the Russian Ministry of Justice made in a 10-page statement of immunity it delivered to the U.S. State Department. If such alleged hacking happened at all, which, understand, they're not saying it did, but if it did, they say that such alleged hypothetical hacking would have been a military action and as such shielded by the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act of 1976, a U.S. law that affords foreign governments a degree of immunity for some actions they take inside the U.S., if, that is, they took any such alleged action at all. Finally, in a story that's far less funny than bald retelling suggests, a Swedish man has received 6.5 years in prison for mailing a letter bomb to what he thought was the address of a Bitcoin exchange that wouldn't change his password. Jermu Michael Salonen of Gullspång, Sweden, was a customer of London-based CryptoPay, a site that enables altcoin enthusiasts to indulge their passion for trading this now rapidly depreciating currency. Mr. Salonen sent the device, which was real and potentially lethal, to what he thought was CryptoPay's address, but that in fact was the address of an accounting firm CryptoPay had once used. The London Met's bomb squad rendered the device safe, but it could have been lethal, and it sat in the mailroom unopened for 5 months. There are a few lessons to be drawn from this incident. First, don't gamble with more than you can afford to lose. Second, don't expect your accountants to open mail you send them promptly. And third, for heaven's sake, Mr. Salonen, invest in a password manager. Heck, even writing your password on a sticky note tacked to the underside of your keyboard would be suboptimal, but better than sending someone a letter bomb.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And joining me once again is Jonathan Katz. He's a professor of computer science at the University of Maryland. He's also director of the Maryland Cybersecurity Center. Jonathan, it's great to have you back. We had a story come by from Science Daily, and this was about some researchers at Georgia Tech who had discovered some side-channel vulnerabilities with some encryption in smartphones. Fill us in. What's going on here?
This was an attack that the researchers found on a version of OpenSSL that was being used on these smartphones. And like you said, it was a side channel attack, which means that they were kind of using information that was being leaked from the device itself, physical information that was being leaked, in order to figure something out about the encryption key being used on the device.
Hmm. So is this like RF energy leaking from the device?
Right. That would be an example. And what's interesting about these side channel attacks in general is that typically when we think about security of an encryption scheme and when we analyze security of an encryption scheme, we think only in terms of the plain text messages going in and the encrypted messages going out, and then we argue that the attacker won't be able to figure out anything about the message from the encryption that it sees. But we typically don't think about all this other information that might be coming out of the device, like you just mentioned. But it turns out that those can be a pretty powerful attack vector that can allow an attacker to figure out more about the encryption than they should be able to.
So help me understand. Is this the information within the device itself is traveling around in an unencrypted state, and they were able to sort of suss out what the keys would be in this case? Is that what was going on?
That's the basic idea. It's a little more complicated than that, but basically by looking at emanations from the device, they were able to figure out in particular, when some operation was being done and when it wasn't being done. And that information could then be correlated with the bits of the key. And gradually, you know, by repeating this enough times, they were able to figure out the entire key from the device.
I see. So I suppose part of this is they had to be in fairly close proximity to the device in this case.
They did. In their experiments, they actually had a measuring device that was not touching the phone, but it was right up next to it. But they claimed that in principle, an attacker might be able to do it from further away or might be able to have a recording device nearby the phone with the owner of the phone not suspecting anything.
And what's your take on ways to prevent this sort of thing?
Well, researchers have been looking actually for a while at these attacks and then also how to prevent them. What's, you know, maybe especially interesting here is that the OpenSSL libraries were designed in part to prevent these kind of attacks, but nevertheless, the researchers were able to carry out the attack anyway. So I guess it just shows they'll have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to make either the physical device not leak this information anymore, or to make sure that the algorithm that they're using for the encryption is kind of leaking things that are independent of the key. But it's definitely something that's quite difficult to do.
Yeah. All right, Jonathan Katz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.